The Secret of Chimneys, Agatha Christie, Chapter 16, Tea in the Schoolroom. Anthony regained the terrace with the feeling uppermost in his mind that the only safe place for private conversations was the middle of the lake. The resonant boom of a gong sounded from the house, and Treadwell appeared in a stately fashion from a side door.
"Luncheon is served, my lord."
"Ah," said Lord Caddaham, brisking up a little. "Lunch." At that moment, two children burst out of the house. They were high-spirited young women of 12 and 10, and though their names might be Dulcie and Daisy, as Bundle had affirmed, they appeared to be more generally known as Goggle and Winkle. They executed a kind of war dance, interspersed with shrill hoops, until Bundle emerged and quelled them. "Where's Mademoiselle?" she demanded. "She's got the migraine. The migraine! The migraine!" chanted Winkle. "Hurrah!" said Goggle, joining in. Lord Caddaham had succeeded in shepherding most of his guests into the house. Now he laid a restraining hand on Anthony's arm. "Come to my study," he breathed. "I've got something rather special there." Slinking down the hall, far more like a thief than like the master of the house, Lord Caddaham gained the shelter of his sanctum. Here he unlocked a cupboard and produced various bottles. "Talking to foreigners always makes me so thirsty," he explained apologetically. "I don't know why it is." There was a knock on the door, and Virginia popped her head round the corner of it. "Got a special cocktail for me?" she demanded.
"Of course," said Lord Caddaham hospitably. "Come in."
The next few minutes were taken up with serious rites. "I needed that," said Lord Caddaham with a sigh, as he replaced his glass on the table. "As I said just now, I find talking to foreigners particularly fatiguing. I think it's because they're so polite. Come along, let's have some lunch." He led the way to the dining room. Virginia put her hand on Anthony's arm and drew him back a little. "I've done my good deed for the day," she whispered. "I got Lord Caddaham to take me to see the body."
"Well?" demanded Anthony eagerly.
One theory of his was to be proved or disproved. Virginia was shaking her head. "You were wrong," she whispered. "It's Prince Michael, all right."
"Oh," Anthony was deeply chagrined.
"And Mademoiselle had the migraine?" he added aloud, in a dissatisfied tone. "What has that got to do with it?"
"Probably nothing. But I wanted to see her. You see, I found out that Mademoiselle has the second room from the end, the one where I saw the light go up last night."
"That's interesting."
"Probably there's nothing in it. All the same, I mean to see Mademoiselle before the day is out."
Lunch was somewhat of an ordeal. Even the cheerful impartiality of Bundle failed to reconcile the heterogeneous assembly. The Baron and Andrassy were correct, formal, full of etiquette, and had the air of attending a meal in a mausoleum. Lord Caddaham was lethargic and depressed. Bill Eversley stared longingly at Virginia. George, very mindful of the trying position in which he found himself, conversed weightily with the Baron and Mr. Isaacstein. Goggle and Winkle, completely beside themselves with joy at having a murder in the house, had to be continually checked and kept under, while Mr. Hiram Fish slowly masticated his food and drawled out dry remarks in his own peculiar idiom. Superintendent Battle had considerately vanished, and nobody knew what had become of him.
"Thank God that's over," murmured Bundle to Anthony as they left the table. "And George is taking the foreign contingent over to the Abbey this afternoon to discuss state secrets."
"That will possibly relieve the atmosphere," agreed Anthony. "I don't mind the American so much," continued Bundle. "He and Father can talk first editions together quite happily in some secluded spot. Mr. Fish," as the object of their conversation drew near, "I'm planning a peaceful afternoon for you." The American bowed.
"That's too kind of you, Lady Eileen."
"Mr. Fish," said Anthony, "had a quite peaceful morning." Mr. Fish shot a quick glance at him.
"Ah, you observe me, then, in my secluded retreat? There are moments, sir, when far from the madding crowd is the only motto for a man of quiet tastes."
Bundle had drifted on, and the American and Anthony were left together. The former dropped his voice a little.
"I opine," he said, "that there is considerable mystery about this little dust-up."
"Any amount of it," said Anthony.
"That guy with the bald head was perhaps a family connection?"
"Something of the kind."
"These Central European nations beat the band," declared Mr. Fish. "It's kind of being rumored around that the deceased gentleman was a Royal Highness."
"Is that so? Do you know?"
"He was staying here as Count Stanislaus," replied Anthony evasively. To this, Mr. Fish offered no further rejoinder than the somewhat cryptic, "Oh, boy!" after which he relapsed into silence for some moments. "This police captain of yours," he observed at last, "Battle, or whatever his name is he the goods all right?"
"Scotland Yard thinks so," replied Anthony dryly.
"He seems kind of hidebound to me," remarked Mr. Fish. "No hustle to him. This big idea of his, letting no one leave the house, what is there to it?" He darted a very sharp look at Anthony as he spoke. "Everyone's got to attend the inquest tomorrow morning, you see."
"That's the idea, is it? No more to it than that? No question of Lord Caterham's guests being suspected?"
"My dear Mr. Fish, I was getting a mite uneasy, being a stranger in this country. But of course it was an outside job, I remember now. Window found unfastened, wasn't it?"
"It was," said Anthony, looking straight in front of him.
Mr. Fish sighed. After a minute or two, he said in a plaintive tone, "Young man, do you know how they get the water out of a mine?"
"How?"
"By pumping. But it's almighty hard work. I observe the figure of my genial host detaching himself from the group over yonder. I must join him."
Mr. Fish walked gently away, and Bundle drifted back again.
"Funny fish, isn't he?" she remarked.
"He is."
"It's no good looking for Virginia," said Bundle sharply.
"I wasn't."
"You were. I don't know how she does it. It isn't what she says. I don't even believe it's what she looks. But, oh boy, she gets there every time. Anyway, she's on duty elsewhere for the time. She told me to be nice to you, and I'm going to be nice to you, by force if necessary."
"No force required," Anthony assured her.
"But if it's all the same to you, I'd rather you were nice to me on the water, in a boat."
"That's not a bad idea," said Bundle meditatively.
They strolled down to the lake together. "There's just one question I'd like to ask you," said Anthony as he paddled gently out from the shore, "before we turn to really interesting topics. Business before pleasure."
"Whose bedroom do you want to know about now?" asked Bundle with weary patience.
"Nobody's bedroom for the moment, but I'd like to know where you got your French governess from."
"The man's bewitched," said Bundle.
"I got her from an agency, and I pay her £100 a year, and her Christian name is Genevieve. Anything more you want to know?"
"We'll assume the agency," said Anthony.
"What about her references?"
"Oh, glowing. She lived for 10 years with the Countess of Whatnot."
"Whatnot being?"
"The Comtesse de Breteuil, Chateau de Breteuil, Dinard."
"You didn't actually see the Comtesse yourself. It was all done by letter?"
"Exactly."
"Hmm," said Anthony.
"You intrigue me," said Bundle. "You intrigue me enormously. Is it love or crime?"
"Probably sheer idiocy on my part. Let's forget it."
"Let's forget it," says he negligently, having extracted all the information he wants. "Mr. Cade, who do you suspect?"
I rather suspect Virginia as being the most unlikely person, or possibly Bill.
What about you?
Member of the aristocracy joins in secret the Comrades of the Red Hand. It would create a sensation, all right.
Anthony laughed. He liked Bundle, though he was a little afraid of the shrewd penetration of her sharp gray eyes.
You must be proud of all this, he said suddenly, waving his hands towards the great house in the distance.
Bundle screwed up her eyes and tilted her head on one side.
Yes, it means something, I suppose. But one's too used to it. Anyway, we're not here very much. Too deadly dull. We've been at Cowes and Deauville all the summer after town, and then up to Scotland. Chimneys has been swathed in dust sheets for about 5 months. Once a week, they take the dust sheets off, and coaches full of tourists come and gape and listen to Treadwell.
On your right is the portrait of the 4th Marchioness of Caterham, painted by Sir Joshua Reynolds, etc. And Ed or Bert, the humorist of the party, nudges his girl and says, "Hey, Gladys, they've got 2 pennyworth of pictures here, all right." And then they go and look at more pictures and yawn and shuffle their feet and wish it was time to go home.
Yet, history has been made here once or twice, by all accounts.
You've been listening to George, said Bundle sharply.
That's the kind of thing he's always saying.
But Anthony had raised himself on his elbow and was staring at the shore.
Is that a third suspicious stranger I see, standing disconsolately by the boathouse? Or is it one of the house party?
Bundle lifted her head from the scarlet cushion.
It's Bill, she said. He seems to be looking for something.
He's probably looking for me, said Bundle, without enthusiasm.
Shall we row quickly in the opposite direction?
That's quite the right answer, but it should be delivered with more enthusiasm.
I shall row with double vigor after that rebuke.
Not at all, said Bundle. I have my pride. Row me to where that young ass is waiting. Somebody's got to look after him, I suppose. Virginia must have given him the slip. One of these days, inconceivable as it seems, I might want to marry George, so I might as well practice being one of our well-known political hostesses.
Anthony pulled obediently towards the shore.
And what's to become of me, I should like to know, he complained. I refuse to be the unwanted third. Is that the children I see in the distance?
Yes.
Be careful, or they'll rope you in.
I'm rather fond of children, said Anthony.
I might teach them some nice, quiet, intellectual game.
Well, don't say I didn't warn you.
Having relinquished Bundle to the care of the disconsolate Bill, Anthony strolled off to where various shrill cries disturbed the peace of the afternoon. He was received with acclamation.
Are you any good at playing Red Indians? Asked Guggle sternly.
Rather, said Anthony. You should hear the noise I make when I'm being scalped. Like this, he illustrated.
Not so bad, said Winkle grudgingly. Now, do the scalpers yell?
Anthony obliged with a blood-curdling noise. In another minute, the game of Red Indians was in full swing.
About an hour later, Anthony wiped his forehead and ventured to inquire after Mademoiselle's migraine. He was pleased to hear that that lady had entirely recovered. So popular had he become that he was urgently invited to come and have tea in the schoolroom.
And then you can tell us about the man you saw hung, urged Guggle.
Did you say you'd got a bit of rope with you? Asked Winkle.
It's in my suitcase, said Anthony solemnly. You shall each have a piece of it.
Winkle immediately let out a wild Indian yell of satisfaction.
We'll have to go and get washed, I suppose, said Guggle gloomily.
You will come to tea, won't you? You won't forget?
Anthony swore solemnly that nothing should prevent him keeping the engagement. Satisfied, the youthful pair beat a retreat towards the house. Anthony stood for a minute looking after them, and as he did so, he became aware of a man leaving the other side of the little copse of trees
and hurrying away across the park. He felt almost sure that it was the same black-bearded stranger he'd encountered that morning. While he was hesitating whether to go after him or not, the trees just ahead of him were parted, and Mr. Hiram Fish stepped out into the open. He started slightly when he saw Anthony. "A peaceful afternoon, Mr. Fish?" inquired the latter. "I thank you, yes." Mr. Fish did not look as peaceful as usual, however. His face was flushed, and he was breathing hard as though he'd been running. He drew out his watch and consulted it. "I guess," he said softly, "it's just about time for your British institution of afternoon tea." Closing his watch with a snap, Mr. Fish ambled gently away in the direction of the house. Anthony stood in a brown study and awoke with a start to the fact that Superintendent Battle was standing beside him. Not the faintest sound had heralded his approach, and he seemed, literally, to have materialized from space. "Where did you spring from?" asked Anthony, irritably. With a slight jerk of his head, Battle indicated the little copse of trees behind them. "It seems a popular spot this afternoon," remarked Anthony. "You were very lost in thought, Mr. Cade." "I was indeed. Do you know what I was doing, Battle? I was trying to put 2 and 1 and 5 and 3 together so as to make 4. And it can't be done, Battle. It simply can't be done." "There's difficulties that way," agreed the detective. "But you're just the man I wanted to see. Battle, I want to go away. Can it be done?" True to his creed, Superintendent Battle showed neither emotion nor surprise. His reply was easy and matter-of-fact. "That depends, sir, as to where you want to go." "I'll tell you exactly, Battle. I'll lay my cards on the table. I want to go to Dinard, to the chateau of Madame la Comtesse de Breteuil. Can it be done?" "When do you want to go, Mr. Cade?" "Say tomorrow, after the inquest. I should be back here by Sunday evening." "I see," said the superintendent, with peculiar solidity. "Well, what about it?" "I've no objection, provided you go where you say you're going, and come straight back here." "You're a man in 1,000, Battle. Either you have taken an extraordinary fancy to me, or else you're extraordinarily deep. Which is it?" Superintendent Battle smiled a little, but didn't answer. "Well, well," said Anthony. I expect you'll take your precautions. Discreet minions of the law will follow my suspicious footsteps. So be it. But I do wish I knew what it was all about." "I don't get you, Mr. Cade." "The memoirs. What all the fuss is about. Were they only memoirs? Or have you got something up your sleeve?" Battle smiled again. "Take it like this. I'm doing you a favor because you've made a favorable impression on me, Mr. Cade. I'd like you to work in with me over the case. The amateur and the professional, they go well together. The one has the intimacy, so to speak, and the other the experience." "Well," said Anthony slowly, "I don't mind admitting that I've always wanted to try my hand at unraveling a murder mystery. Any ideas about the case at all, Mr. Cade?" "Plenty of them," said Anthony, "but they're mostly questions." "As, for instance?" "Who steps into the murdered Michael's shoes? It seems to me that that's important." A rather wry smile came over Superintendent Battle's face. "I wondered if you'd think of that, sir. Prince Nicholas Obolovich is the next heir, first cousin of this gentleman." "And where is he at the present moment?" asked Anthony, turning away to light a cigarette. "Don't tell me you don't know, Battle, because I shan't believe you." "We've reason to believe that he's in the United States. He was, until quite lately, at all events, raising money on his expectations." Anthony gave vent to a surprised whistle. "I get you," said Anthony. Michael was backed by England, Nicholas by America. In both countries, a group of financiers are anxious to obtain the oil concessions. The Loyalist Party adopted Michael as their candidate. Now they'll have to look elsewhere. Gnashing of teeth on the part of Isaacstein and company, and Mr. George Lomax. Rejoicings in Wall Street. Am I right?
You're not far off, said Superintendent Battle.
Hmm, said Anthony. I almost dare swear that I know what you're doing in that copse.
The detective smiled, but made no reply.
International politics are very fascinating, said Anthony. But I fear I must leave you. I have an appointment in the schoolroom.
He strode briskly away towards the house. Inquiries of the dignified Treadwell showed him the way to the schoolroom. He tapped on the door and entered, to be greeted by squeals of joy. Goggle and Winkle immediately rushed at him and bore him in triumph to be introduced to Mademoiselle. For the first time, Anthony felt a qualm. Mademoiselle Brune was a small, middle-aged woman with a sallow face, pepper-and-salt hair, and a budding mustache. As the notorious foreign adventuress, she did not fit into the picture at all.
I believe, said Anthony to himself, I'm making the most utter fool of myself. Never mind, I must go through with it now. He was extremely pleasant to Mademoiselle, and she, on her part, was evidently delighted to have a good-looking young man invade her schoolroom. The meal was a great success. But that evening, alone in the charming bedchamber that had been allotted to him, Anthony shook his head several times. I'm wrong, he said to himself. For the second time, I'm wrong. Somehow or other, I can't get the hang of this thing. He stopped in his pacing of the floor. What the devil? Began Anthony. The door was being softly opened. In another minute, a man had slipped into the room and stood deferentially by the door. He was a big, fair man, squarely built, with high Slavonic cheekbones and dreamy, fanatic eyes. "Who the devil are you?" asked Anthony, staring at him. The man replied in perfect English. "I am Boris Anchukov." "Prince Michael's servant, eh?" "That is so. I served my master. He is dead. Now I serve you."
"That's very kind of you," said Anthony, "but I don't happen to want a valet."
"You are my master now. I will serve you faithfully."
"Yes, but look, here, I don't need a valet. I can't afford one."
Boris Anchukov looked at him with a touch of scorn.
"I do not ask for money. I served my master. So will I serve you to the death."
Stepping quickly forward, he dropped on one knee, caught Anthony's hand, and placed it on his forehead. Then he rose swiftly and left the room as suddenly as he'd come. Anthony stared after him, his face a picture of astonishment.
"That's damned odd," he said to himself.
"A faithful sort of dog. Curious, the instincts these fellows have." He rose and paced up and down.
"All the same," he muttered, "it's awkward. Damned awkward."